Thank you, Butch. I appreciate that a lot. And how sweet it is. Look at all you nice-looking folks out here. I was a really moving ceremony a while ago, and got me where I live, right in the middle of the heart. You can't imagine how tickled I was when Don and the committee asked me to come. It's such a joy to be invited anywhere. For years and years, no one invited me to anything. They told me where to go real regular. My name is Jimmy Smith, and I'm a very, very, very happy sober alcoholic. Hello, everybody. I'm from Lincolnton, Georgia. Little town, 1,406 people. Our largest industry is the 300-pound Avon lady. And when she comes calling, you better answer, I tell you. I got to do something now, but my wife's not going to appreciate it. But I got to have my long-suffering Al-Anon to please stand. Joanne. I sometimes think that she didn't really put up with a whole lot. That's when I'm on one of my ego trips. I know she did put up with a lot. You know what an ego is? I never realized I had one until the last year or two. And by the way, I've been sober 11 years, 2 months, and 30 days. That don't mean much to some people, but it just tickles me to death. And it tickles her quite a bit also. You know, I'm a former school teacher and football coach, and now I'm president of a bakery, and vice president and cook and dishwasher and delivery boy. Always, I bake cakes in my kitchen and I peddle them out on the street. I used to say I made my living that way, but that was a lie. My wife makes a living, and I make my spending money selling cakes that way, but I enjoy it a whole lot. But having been a coach, I get invited to schools and all quite a bit to speak and talk, you know, and most dunks I know are very, very intelligent people. And we are very creative people, and I'm kind of on the high bracket of all of that. So when they invited me to come to talk to this fifth grade class, I put my brain to work. And I went, I had a glass of water and a good lively worm. And I dropped him in the water, and he just swam all around so nice. I dipped him out and dropped him in a glass of whiskey. He just died right there. And I just stood back so proud of myself. I said, boy, have I taught these kids something here. Just look at here what I have done. And I said, what does that prove to you? The kid on the front row raised his hand and proves if you drink liquor, you won't have wires. That's when my ego kind of fell out the bottom, you know. I'm going to tell you what an ego is. Back in 1906, I believe it was, Clint Mike can tell me exactly when they had the great earthquake in San Francisco. And this drunk had passed out right before that happened. And when he came to and he raised up and he looked at all that destruction, he said, Lord, how will I ever pay for all of this? If there's a judge in here, peace. I don't want to start a war. But most judges I know kind of felt like God went on vacation and left him in charge. And I have been before a few. But this one was particularly bad. I mean, he was the baddest of the bad. He had a poor soul sitting in front of him here just looking awful. He just gave him all he could give him, and he ran out back so proud of himself, and a fly got the buzzing around his head. He was slapping and knocking at the fly, and he got the bailiff up there to help him, and he was slapping and knocking at it, and they were trying to identify. Nobody knew what kind of fly it was. He was just around his head, and he got the sheriff up there, and he couldn't identify. And they were just around his head. Little fella raised his hand and said, I know what it is, Your Honor. He says, you do. He said, what is it? He said, it's a Zuzu fly. He said, I ain't never heard of a Zuzu fly. I said, what kind of fly is that? He said, oh, you know, Your Honor, you kind of always be buzzing around horses' asses. He said, are you trying to say that's what I am? He said, oh, no, sir, Your Honor, but you don't fool them Zuzu flies. This is the greatest part of AA to me. What are we doing? We're laughing. We're having a good time. That's what AA is all about. Nearly every drunk I know has got similar symptoms. I've heard so many talk about having a hole in your belly and the wind's blowing through it and butterflies flying in and out and you're waking up with the fear and the guilt and the shame. You don't fit in any place that you are. You always feel kind of wrong and ill at ease. For a few years, we drank liquor and that makes us feel at ease. We're big enough, tall enough, good-looking enough, fast enough, or whatever. somewhere along the line it quits doing for us and starts doing to us. That's when we're in trouble. Because when you become dry, all you're doing is not drinking. From the time I was coaching, I would be dry 8 or 9 months at a time. But I had the hole in my belly, and the wind blowing through it, and the butterflies had turned into pigeons, and I was full of fear and guilt and remorse and shame all the time. And I couldn't ever sleep at night, and I didn't enjoy anything, really. I put on a good front. The people that didn't know anything about the disease particularly put the arm around me and said, "Oh, Coach, you're looking good." But they couldn't see my insides. They couldn't see the knot my stomach was in. They couldn't feel the fear that I felt. They couldn't feel all the anxieties I felt. That's dry. If all you people had done is got me dry, I'd be ready to shoot every one of you. But thank God you gave me something else. You gave me sobriety. Our laughter is the first half of sobriety. What is sobriety? Dictionary says it is to be calm and rational and normal. So what? I like another definition a whole lot better. I like happy, joyous, and free. I like peace and serenity. That's what AA is about to me, is the happy and joyous part. How do you get sober? And to me, it's so easy now. And I'll get to that little boy later, but it took me a long time to get sober. But if you don't drink today, and you go to meetings today, and you live these 12 steps today, I guarantee you with all my heart and soul, you will get sober. And you get your peace and your joy and your happiness. If you've been around a little while and you don't have it, you're cheating yourself. You need to go back and really get on those 12 steps and get happy. Because, see, I'm not special, and I'm not different, and I'm not unique. I'm a street gutter drunk. We got in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and got happy. And to me, it's the greatest thing that ever was on the face of the earth. All you people are. And it took me a long time to get sober. It took me 10 hard years to get 1 year of sobriety. But they kept telling me, "Jimmy, you keep coming back. We love you." And people would meet me at the door and they'd hug me and kiss me and say, "Jimmy, you're welcome." And I wasn't welcome anywhere for so long that it just thrilled me to death to be welcome somewhere. And I'd come out to the meetings and I'd hear you laughing. You were having a good time. You were enjoying life. And I couldn't believe it, really. I didn't know why. But you were doing that I wasn't doing. I thought you had something here somewhere. And you would hug me and kiss me and say, "Jimmy, we love you. Come back." And I just couldn't marvel over that. I was the most unlovable human being that I have ever known. But you'd just meet me like that and you'd greet me and then you'd tell me to come back to you love me. And my present sponsor is a smart aleck, always has been. I guess he always will be. He told me one night, said, "Jimmy, please keep coming back." He said, "We need you." I said, "Oh, I've got you now, buddy. Ain't nothing you need me for." He said, "Oh, yes, it is. If you tell the newcomers if they keep drinking, they're going to end up just like you." And I was so proud of that, I came home bragging to my wife about it. She just shook her head and said, "Man, you are sick, you're not." But that's why it's so wonderful for me now that I can stand here flat-footed and bare-faced and look you square in the eye and guarantee it works. Not a yep, not a am, not a maybe. Like a some it will, some it won't. Hadn't a word been changed in 50 years? And all kind of brilliant people that wanted to change it. All kind of highly intelligent, educated idiots wanted to change this and change that and change the other. So they got sober. And then they realized there wasn't any need to change anything. And I go back to again, I'm not unique or special. No one in this room is too dumb, pray A. And none of you sure ain't too smart, pray A. But a lot of you think you are. And I see it all the time, and I happen to have been one of them. I want to change a lot, and I want to do all kind of things. Of course, I learned better, and I learned different. Laughter. Living. This is one of the greatest parts of AA. See, before I met you people, I used to have strange, strange habits. I used to wake up or come to in a strange jail. That's one you don't go to real often, you know. And I think it's Tuesday, and it might be Friday of the next week. I wake up full of that horrible fear, all that scared to death because I didn't know why I was there. And I didn't know where I was, and I didn't know what I'd done. That's the most horrible feeling on earth to me, is waking up with that kind of horribly frightening fear. And I woke up in hospitals a lot, my arms and legs spread out and a band across my belly, and usually I'd nest all over myself, begging for somebody to do something for me, and they'd just say, "Shut up now, shut up." And I woke up in the woods a lot. I woke up in the woods, in the bushes, and in the briar patches, and again, I'd nest all over myself, and I'd have ants and spiders crawling all in the clothes. I don't do that anymore. And you know why I don't? Because of you people. 86,000 groups of you people taught me how to be sober. Because, see, we can do what I couldn't do. I tried every way in the world I know of to be sober. And I tried it and tried it and tried it, but I couldn't be sober. But we can keep me sober. All of you people in this room, the program itself, my God can keep me sober. And I thank you for it every day of my life. And to know that I can walk in 86,000 places and say, hi, I'm Jimmy, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just as welcome as I can be. Nothing in the world thrills me anymore than that. And now, see, I wake up to two miracles every morning. I wake up in my own bed, sober. And I just grin all over. Because I can get up and go to the bathroom. And I can also scratch whatever's itching me. I can scratch it. I know where my truck is. And I know what I did last night. And I know that God knows I'm trying to do what he wants me to do. But the best feeling of that moment every morning is I don't need a drink. Don't need one at all. I don't even want one. And I look at Judy P. sitting here, but I've known for a good many years now. And I think about where she's been and where I've been and a lot of you others have been. And I just think how marvelous this program is. And I see so many miracles in it all the time. And I have to apologize to God every once in a while. And I say, I'm sorry, God. I know I'm supposed to be used to your miracles. But I feel just get overcome by them sometimes. They're just so great. And they are here. I mean, they all is here. That's the first half of AA is that laughter. The second half is love. It took me a long time to get any part of that. But I was real fortunate. Way before I got sober, from 15, 16 years ago, I heard a man speak from California that was a member of the original eight. That was the original eight people that started AA in California sometime in the late 30s. And they did like a lot of us do. They worked the first step and they jumped all the way to number 12. And they went out to the courthouse and they talked to this judge and told him what they wanted to do. And he said, I got just the man for you. He had a man sitting over in the corner shaking like this, just looking horrible, been drunk for weeks. And he said, I was going to put this man on the chain gang. He said, I'm going to give him to you people for 30 days. And you bring him back and I'll decide what to do. Now, eight people got on three-hour shifts. At least one of them were with him at all times. Most of the time, the whole group was with him. And they'd rented an apartment house above a liquor store for the AA meetings. Good place for meetings. Good place. And they took him to the Salvation Army, and they got him some clothes. And in the 30 days, these people were with him nearly all the time. And they fed him real well, and they exercised, and they entertained him. And they took him to AA meetings, and they just crammed it all in him. At the end of 30 days, it was surprising the difference in him. He looked pretty good. He could stand up straight. He could walk around. He had a little bit of color in his cheeks and had a slight twinkle in his eye. And they got him a suit. And they marched him down on the front row of the courthouse and all eight of them sitting right behind him. So proud. You know how proud we can be. Well, we did that, you know. He didn't have nothing to do with it. We did it. And we sat behind him so proud and the judge says, who is this? And he asked the bailiff to find out and he came back. He said, well, that's the man that you gave to these people 30 days ago. The judge said, boy, that's just marvelous. These eight people around that crowd said, it's just wonderful. They got a little tall, and he said, it's just a miracle. One man kept eight people sober for 30 days. That's the love part. Get involved. Get up and get busy doing something in the program. Get off your own pity pot. My first sponsor died with 26 years sobriety. He could not read or write a word. One of the wisest men I've ever known. He kept telling me all the time, Jimmy, give, give. The more you give, the more you get back. And I said, give what, boss? I don't have anything to give. Give what? And he put his arm around me and said, give yourself. Give your time. Give your energy. Sit and listen to somebody that wants to talk. Hug somebody that's crying, that's hurting. Meet a newcomer at the door and hug them and tell them they're welcome and you love them. Tell somebody when they leave that you're glad they were there to come back. And I've learned over the years that's one of the most important things we can do is welcome somebody and to tell them to come back that we love them. Because if they hadn't done me that way, I wouldn't be standing here now. Because they just kept on and kept on welcoming me for these over 10 years that it took me. They didn't say, Jimmy, we're tired of you. We don't want you anymore. You're not trying. They always said, come back. We love you. And they would hug me and they'd kiss me over and over and over. And it wasn't just one group or two groups. There was a lot of different groups that I went to. And nobody knows how much I appreciate all of that. But see, really and truly, you can look at me and know that I'm not supposed to be an alcoholic. I'm too good looking, I'm too intelligent, I'm too charming. But yet here I stand, an alcoholic. It was not my idea. be an alcoholic. And I told you a while ago, I tried not to be one. I became a Baptist Christian in the Baptist church when I was 14 years old. That didn't make me one. It didn't keep me from being one. Later on, when I found out I was a full-blown alcoholic, I tried every way in the world not to be. I'm not knocking any of this now. I'm telling a story. I've been to tent meetings where they place hands on you and they shake and shout to get the demons out. And I've been in meetings where they chant round and round, speaking in tongues to get the demons out. And I went to many psychiatrists, and I had 29 shock treatments. You know what they call it. Hook you up to Georgia Power or Tennessee Power or whatever and burn your brains is what they do on that. That didn't work. And I even went to a witch doctor one time. And that's a good one. I didn't know about that until a couple of years ago. In fact, a lot of my story is told to me, but a fellow in Augusta said, Jim, I've been hearing you talk for years, and you never mentioned going to the witch doctor. Why not? I said, well, Ken, I don't really know, but I did. He said, oh, yes, you did. I took you. So they explained to me that they were babysitting me, trying to keep me from drinking, and I kept telling them if they took me to a witch doctor, he would cure me. So they found one in Augusta, and he sprinkled powder and herbs all over me and wrapped me up like a mummy and dumped me on my mother's back porch like scared out of death. And see, that did work. The only thing worked, I come back again, is you people in this marvelous program. That's why I love to say, we can do what I couldn't do. And it's just so wonderful to say that. See, my father was a country doctor in Lincoln, and he was an alcoholic, and I hated him most of my life. Until I was 19 when he was killed. He embarrassed me, and he humiliated me, and he shamed me a lot, and I swore all my life, I'll never be like my daddy. And I wasn't. I was much worse than he ever thought about me. But I went to college, never had a beer, never had a drink, never intended to have one. But I got to the University of Georgia and all the buddies, you know, peer pressure. Come on, Jimmy, drink a beer, it won't hurt you. And God is my witness, I plan to drink a beer. But for the next 28 years, I never drank a anything. I drank all I could get my hands on, and I was off and running boogie. The first time I drank, I got drunk, I had a blackout. I woke up the next morning, my whole world changed. Up until then, I wanted to be a doctor. I knew I couldn't go to school for 14 years. I knew I couldn't study all that much. So I switched over to phys ed, where I took a lot of badminton, ping pong, horseshoes and such. And I could drink and go on to class, and I could drink and go on to school. My whole world changed right then. It's just unbelievable. And all of my life, I kept telling myself two lies. The first lie, we all know that one, you know. You wake up in a ditch, you're hungover or in trouble. You put your hands on your head and say, oh, God, I'll never take another drink. And we mean it, it's time. But my second big lie was really something. Lincoln County was dry all the time I was drinking. And after I'd been sober about 3 or 4 years, they got together and voted it wet, just for pure means. I'm right up town now, and they got beer and wine everywhere. This makes me sick. But see, I'd have to go 6 miles to the river, cross into South Carolina, 4 more miles to a liquor store. And I tell myself that same second lie, I'm not going to mess up this time. Because I'm not going to get drunk this time. I'm going to buy a half a pint. You never got drunk on a half a pint in your life. But I'd go to the store and buy a half pint, and I'd take a drink coming back to the river. And I'd turn around and go back to the liquor store and buy all my money to buy. And I'd be off and running and drunk again. It took me forever almost to learn that the first drink got me drunk. It wasn't the bottom of the jug or the last one, the very first drink, and I was gone. And see, I was coaching in a little town where I was born and reared. Everybody knew me, and I was trying to hide my alcoholism, and I wouldn't go to bars or juke joint or Legions or whatever to drink. And I'd bring my liquor back home, and I'd come home and get in the bed. And I drank right there in the house. And my wife commutes to Augusta and back. And she'd come home the third, fourth, or fifth day, however long she could stand it. And when she'd had all she could stand, she'd call the law. And they would all come over to my house, both of them. They wouldn't have a warrant. They picked me up, came into jail. Because St. Lincoln was 2 blocks, 1 block downtown, 1 block uptown. I lived 2 blocks in that, and the jail was right between me and town. And they picked me up and came into jail, and I could not pay a fine if I happened to have money. I was not allowed to make a phone call. And when I got out, they didn't charge me anything. They didn't even write it up at all. I was just picked up, carried up, locked up in jail. And I used to think they kept me until they got ready to turn me loose. In the last 2 or 3 years, I've learned a lot. I learned that they kept me until she got ready for them to turn me loose. She would call them, she'd take the boys to Myrtle Beach or somewhere, and she'd call them and say, if you see him out of the house, lock him up and keep him until I get back. And they'd be glad to accommodate. Back then, I was the only man in jail most of the time. And at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they locked everything up and went home. Nobody there but me. And that big old empty jail hung on to the back of a big old empty courthouse. And you ever had DTs or hallucinations or something like that, it makes it doubly worse. But I wasn't really accomplishing anything in that jail, you know, being in there by myself all the time. So I started kind of branching out. And I'd go to jail in Augusta and Greenville, South Carolina, and Spartanburg, and so on. And they put you in a drunk tank. 20, 30 other drunks, and we kind of like women in a beauty parlor, men in a barbershop. We get to gossiping, you know, just talking back and forth. And I tell them how they did it. And they said, well, they can't do you that way. You have rights. And I said, no, not Lincoln County, you don't. Anyhow, they made me a list for my rights. Don't forget, I'm intelligent, terribly. And I tell them to the sheriff, and I said, now you violate one more right, and I'm going to sue you. He said, okay. From then on, my wife had to pay $2 to get out of warrant, and I'd have to pay $70 to get out of jail. See, you go back to the intelligent part again. And I went around town bragging to everybody, I showed him, and they just shook their head and said, yeah, you showed him, Marge, you sure did. I managed to graduate from Georgia. I'm still not sure how. It took me 5 years, but I didn't manage to finish. But then it was still when I was 19, so money had been short. I go to Fort Benning now with the little gold bar that says you're an officer and a gentleman. Well, that was a joke showing up. But anyhow, they had officer clubs everywhere down there. And beer was 10 cents, and whiskey was 10 cents a shot, and women like flies. And I just thought I'd really died and gone to heaven. But I had a little money coming in, and I could go over and drink and date all these gorgeous women. See, I'm not 22 years old now. And date all these gorgeous women, but my disease was moving in a hurry. I mean, it was wide open. 4, 5, 6 months after I was there, these women didn't want to go out with me. And I really wasn't sure why then. I guess I didn't know, but I look back now. I'd be dancing one, thinking I'm here to stay. Michael Jackson, somebody stomping all over her feet. And I'd take her over to the table to sit her down, you know, trying to be a gentleman, and I'd turn her over in a chair. Sometimes I'd just lie down on the table and pass out, like where I was, you know. You do that about twice, and they don't want to go anymore. They just don't want to go anymore. So, 22 and a half or so years old, I don't date. I don't go anywhere. I get off duty and I go to my room and I drink. And I was bachelor officer and they gave me Saturday mornings off to take reveille in the morning at 5 o'clock. And I'd come to reveille feeling horrible. But I learned they had something on sick call. I don't care what was wrong. Well, you'd give you the same medicine, broken leg, pneumonia, whatever. They'd give you a bottle of G.I. Jim and a couple of aspirin. And G.I. Jim is tepid hydrate and codeine cough syrup. It had 65% alcohol, a whole lot of codeine. I could drink a bottle of that and walk this high all month. Just float. So I'd come in at night and I'd drink my liquor. And I managed to get out of service again without getting into serious trouble. I'm 25 years old and I'm going to coach now. My first year of coaching. No, you can't coach people's children and drink liquor. Or so I thought. So I go to Savannah though and it's no problem. You know, I've been drinking every day for about 8 years. But nothing, just quit. Just don't drink. And it's about a 3.5 hour drive from home to Savannah, and I drove all the way down there and didn't drink anything. And I was so proud of myself. I said, ain't nothing to this, you know. I got down there and signed the papers, and they invited me to a party. Said, Coach, all the coaches in the county are coming to this party tonight. Said, I want you to be sure and be there. And I got there, and they had big water pots, boiling water in them to cook shrimp. And they had wash tubs with ostrich ice down. And they had wash tubs with beer. And they had wash tubs with liquor. And one of them said, Coach Smith, would you have a beer? I says, yes, thank you, I'll have one. And you know what happened? I got drunk, dog drunk. I spilled the boiling water on the director's feet, scalded them. Everybody down there knew that Coach Smith was a drunk. But they didn't really care. They were in such need of teachers. But I was in a double session school. We started about 7:30 in the morning, got out at 12 o'clock, and I'd come in smelling it like a liquor barrel. The person put his arm around me and said, ooh, Coach. Said, you smelled it like a liquor bottle. Said, what in the world? Do you drink all night or do you drink when you get up? And I said, yes, sir. They didn't fire me, but they didn't ask me to come back the next year either. In the meantime, my lovely bride, we'd been dating 9 years. Very alcoholic behavior, but she was a good Al-Anon way back then. All I needed was to get married, and she straightened me out. Lord, has she been sorry for a lot of years since. But anyhow, we got married and came to Augusta. I knew this principal was going to be different now. There wasn't going to be no hanky-panky with this old gentleman, Carl. So that's when I started becoming dry. And again, I go back to be, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't like being a drunk. didn't want to be what I was. And I started being dry for 8 or 9 months at a time, and I couldn't stand it. My life was just miserable on the inside. Outside, I looked happy. And I would look forward to this big ball game on Friday night. If we win it, everything's going to be great, and we win it. I feel that let-down feeling. And I got the feeling all the time, is this all there is? They even wrote a song about it in the 40s, and Peggy Lee sang it. If that's all it is, let's have a party. And I lived by that for a while. It was just, I couldn't be happy. I couldn't enjoy things. I never felt right about anything. I'd get drunk every 8 or 9 months down there, and I managed to stay 2 years. And then I got a chance to come home. Lincoln is my home. Y'all don't know it, but Lincoln County wins an awful lot of football games. We are known all over the southeast down there as the small football capital school in the country. We're Class A. We got less than 300 kids. We won the state 4 out of the last 5 times. In fact, in 60, my first year there, in 61, 2, and 3, we won the state. When I had to resign in 1970, I told my wife, I said, they're going to miss me when I'm gone. Since I've been gone, they've won the region 20 times. They've won the state 8 times. They've been runner-up 6 times. And it hurts my feelings that they didn't miss me a little bit. But then I came home. I wasn't head coach. I was defensive coordinator. And everything was going good, and I'd make it these 8 or 9 months again, and then I just couldn't stand it, and I'd tell myself that lie again. As I went across the river, I'm not going to mess up this time. And I'd get that half pint, and then I'd be off and running, and I'd be drunk again. In 61, we were state runner-ups. In 62, we won the state. In 63, we won the state. Little school like Lincoln, which was Class C back then, we were going to coach the high school All-Stars in Atlanta. And they said, Jimmy, it's going to be great, but you can't drink this summer. Man, you can't tell a drunk he can't drink. My heavens, nice. School was out, and I had to, you know, get a half a pint. And I did, and I got drunk and had a wreck, and I cut my face all up. I had to resign. And I didn't get to coach the All-Stars. And for years, I blamed the sheriff and the state patrol and everybody else. It was their fault that I had to resign. Anyhow, for 2 years, I drank very little alcohol in that form. I drank liquor. I drank it mostly on the floor or the ground or the bushes. And I could drink this cough syrup mixed with codeine and Nematal and alcohol, and I could function reasonably. And I started drinking 4, 6, 8 ounces of that stuff for about 2 years, and nobody knew it, really. So they hired me back for the same job, and I went back at the same job. And I ended up in 1970 drinking a quart and a half a day. I looked like a zombie. I looked like I'd been dead a week. I got down to 122 or 3 pounds. I'm 6 foot tall. My eyes hanging way back here and big old freckles and hanging all down in them. This is when I'm 35 or 6 years old. You can get younger in AA too. Because I'd be in a strange jail then, 35 or 6, and hadn't bathed or shaved for 3 or 4 weeks and had my teeth. I've gotten in trouble real young. I had my teeth in my pocket and I couldn't walk anything. I'd be just toddling around feeling horrible. Everybody be calling me Pop. It'd be Pops this and Pops that. And I get sober enough in a few days to talk, and I said, what do you mean, Pops? How old do you think I am? They say 68, 70, 75 years old. And that was when I was 35 and 36. And you don't know I'm 50 now, I don't believe. Give me a break, I'm 57. And I wouldn't swap who I am or what I am or where I am with anybody on earth. I believe I'm one of the happiest people that ever lived. And I am so joyful and happy and thankful for all of you people for that. But I had to resign again in 70. And people, we have a progressive disease. It won't get any better. As long as we're fooling with it, it won't get any better. In 1970, I've been in jail 35 or 40 times. And I've been in hospitals 35 or 40. In 1970, I've been in jail 35 or 40 times. I've been in hospital 35 or 40 times. I had all these shock treatments, or a lot of them, and all these other things. And I told my wife, it can't, and I had 7 DUIs. And I told my wife, I said, can't get no worse than this. But from 70 to June 1st, 79, which is my sobriety date, I went back to jail another 190 to 200 times. I went back to hospitals 80 to 90 times. And I went to prison one time. And I went to 2 Christian homes for alcoholics. The judge sent me to a 28-day treatment program in South Georgia for a whole year. He said, if anybody needs it, you do. I was beating up my cops in jail, and I was beating up my inmates in jail, and I had hallucinations, convulsions, and DTs many times. All after I said it can't get any worse. Please believe me, it gets worse and worse and worse. No such word as worse unless you're an alcoholic and you go back out and drink. You'll know what it means then. No question, it only gets worse. But in 1970, I thought everything in the world had fallen there. I'd been a successful coach of a respected family in the county. Everything I thought was should have been great and perfect, but here I was, had to resign again. For a while, I could make somebody believe that I used to coach or that I played ball with, that I was going to die if they didn't take me to get me something to drink. But that didn't last long. They finally could see through that. And I'd go uptown and beg on the streets for a quarter, 50 cents. Anything I could get my hands on, begging people to help me and let me have a little something to drink. And I got where they wouldn't do that. They'd tell me, I'll take you to the doctor, Jimmy. I'll buy you some food. And I'd go in the stores and steal right off the shelves. Lemon extract, linens I'd say. So say I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a beer-holic, a gin-holic. I drank gallons and gallons of linens out the shade and gallons of lemon extract, all the other extracts, all the half tonic, now wash perfume. That is my wife ever got at me. Some company gave her a little bottle of perfume that cost $100, and I drank it one night. Worst thing about that, though, for the next 3 or 4 days, both ends were just awful. The guy, well, wasn't anyone helping me, and I had to do something, and I started reading labels. I found something called Miles Nervine. Said, if you take 2 teaspoons, some other folks have tried it. To take 2 teaspoons every 4 hours, it'll calm you down, and I'm a good drunk. I drank a bottle every 3 or 4 hours, and boy, did it calm me down. Just out like this table, flat out. About the 3rd day of that, my wife came home, and I was just practically dead. And she couldn't find any liquor or anything, you know what was going on. So she asked around town, and they told her what I'd been buying. And she called Dr. Pennington. He said, it's the bromide in it. And I've since learned that that was one of the earlier detox methods. But the bromide was like rust on my cells. And it almost killed me. For 5 days, she hand-fed me. Because they were waiting on the Georgia Regional Hospital in Augusta to open to take me out there. For the next 3 days, I could get up and go to the table and eat. But I'd hurry back to bed, thought I was having the most beautiful dreams anybody ever had. I heard the sweetest music, saw the prettiest lights. I went on the other side of Mars and looked at everything. It was wonderful. And then he got me in the regional. And they told her and told me that it would take months and months to get this out of my system. So I stayed 6 months. And it got clean and it got sober or dry and I got free of all of that mess. And they had a gym and a swimming pool and all these things. And I had exercised and I'd put on some weight. And I had the world by the tail again. She was going to take me back and I had a chance for a job. Everything was looking good. Look at the second step. It says, came to believe. With a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Man, I ain't crazy. When I'm drinking, I'm crazy as a bat. When I'm sober, I got much sense as anybody. That's where I was wrong. So wrong. I went back to the regional, they tell me, 34 more times. And I went to all the other hospitals and all the other treatment places many times. And then they started taking me to Linwood, which is the VA hospital in Augusta. And I'd act up on the alcohol unit and get drunk and get in a fight. And they put me in 15 East, which is the nut ward. And me and the other nuts would be there together for a few weeks. And I never didn't know really who was the craziest, me or them. And went from there to worse and worse and worse again. They started taking me to Milledgeville. And Milledgeville is the state hospital for the criminally insane and the hopeless, helpless drunk. There was no treatment. You didn't even make a billfold or a belt. You sat. And they'd take 60 or 70 drunks and put us on the same floor with 60 or 70 crazier people. Possibly crazier people. And we'd be all mixed together and had a little bit of room. An army bunk. You rub the elbow with this, rub the wall with one elbow and touch it all with your hands. Had a little chair and a window and I'd sit in my chair an awful lot. Because they'd take you and you get out in the hall with these other people and they'd have a bowel movement and run down the leg and pick it up and throw it at you. And they sit down at the table, eat with one hand, masturbate with the other hand. And they stick up behind you and try to bite you. And they spit on you when you walk by. So I stayed a lot in my room. Most of the time I sat in my room and they folks kept a alley full of tranquilizers. Always put me on the 3rd floor. Big oak trees, limbs coming right up to the windows and birds would come light. I'm light on the limbs and I'd sit and talk to the birds. And I promised the birds I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not ever going to drink again as long as I live. And I promised my wife and my sons, and I promised God, and I promised everybody I ever knew I'm not going to ever drink again. And I'd sit there and do that over and over and over all day. There's a busy highway out in front of me that I could see cars going and coming. And I tell them, I'm going to do that. I'm going to ride. And have the children in the back of the pickups and boats going fishing and picnicking. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take my sons and do the things I'm supposed to do. Because I'm not a criminal and I'm not an animal. I shouldn't be locked up here like I am. And I'd go over that over and over, and they'd let me come home in a few months on a trial basis. And I might be home 2 days or 4 days before I tell myself that same big second lie again. I'm going to go buy a half a pint. And you can't mess up on a half a pint. And I'd get drunk, and I'd be right back there as soon as I was detoxed, sitting in the same chair, looking out the same window, talking to the same bird, saying, I ain't going to drink anymore. I'm not ever going to drink again as long as I live. But I'm not a criminal. I'm not an alcoholic. People, when you get out of a place like that once, much less 10, 20, unknown number of times, you got a chance for a job. You got a chance for your family to take you back. And you even think about taking one little drink. That's the insanity of alcoholism. Thinking that it's going to be different this time. Thinking that you're not going to mess up this time. It's going to get worse. Nothing in the world is going to ever make it any better except where you're sitting right now. And please don't believe you got to go where I did to be an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. But you don't have to go where I did to be one. I got a good buddy in my home next door group there. She's 15 and been sober 2 years. If you're in this room, you didn't ride by here, so that looks like a nice place to visit. You got a reason to be in here, or you wouldn't be here. Please hang around and find out the joy and the peace and the happiness that's in this room. And God's got something He wants you to do. Hang around and see what it is. If we were on a big old raft out in the middle of the ocean, you wouldn't be hanging over on the edge of it. Or you'd be afraid a big old shark would reach up and grab you. Do the same thing with AA. Jump over in the middle of it. You'd be in the middle of that raft. You're in the middle of AA. That's more important than the other side. Jump in and get busy and get going and get to doing and you get happy. And that's where the peace and the joy and the serenity and it all comes from. Because, see, you got to go back now to 1970. When I first went to the Richmond, it was a very, very dear lady to me. Carried my wife and I to our first AA meeting. We didn't know anything about it, but we went, closed meeting. She went over there and I went over here and we came out, got in the car and said, Sugar, what'd they tell you? She said, they told me that I'd been wrong, that I shouldn't pull out your liquor. And I fell in love with AA right there. I knew y'all was the greatest people ever was on the face of the earth to stop them pouring out my liquor. But the real reason I would go, he made me feel better. I would go to the meetings and I would feel better. Because see, during all my drinking and all those shock treatments, they had told my wife that he can't stay sober. That he's a wet brain. He's damaged his brain so bad he doesn't know right from wrong. If he ever does anything, it'll be no more than pump gas somewhere and he won't do that long because he's going to die. Or he's either going to go completely insane. And she would tell him when she would bring me to the meeting that he can't stay sober. And they would pat her and hug her and say, keep bringing him back. And all the time they kept bringing me back, she kept telling them. And they said, you keep bringing him. And I would come and you would hug me and you'd welcome me and you'd laugh. And I would feel better when I left. But I'd hear people speak, been in jail twice and hospital twice or something. I really couldn't relate to that. And I think, boy, this is great for y'all. I just wish it worked for me. I just wish it would. And I go back to now again, you don't have to do what I did when I was, see, we don't see ourselves like other people see us. When I was in college, I used to watch this little boy, he'd get drunk, lay his head on the table, they'd slip a saucer in his mouth, fill it up with beer, and he'd slurp it up. I used to watch it. Man, if I ever get bad as Frank, I'm gonna quit. And I ran up on Frank in the program 7, 8 years ago. He said, you know, Jimmy, we was in college, I used to watch you. Always said, if I get bad as Jimmy, I'm gonna quit. Marvelous thing how we don't see ourselves as other people see us. That's a marvelous thing. I promise you start with that if you live and you keep coming to AA, you get sober. I promise you something else. That if you live and you keep drinking, you'll do everything I've done. But you don't have to. You're right where you need to be now. I kept coming in and out of AA and back and forth and back and forth and a dear lady from home and moved to Albany, Georgia. They had a state convention in Augusta in 1975, and that's where I was in the hospital. She got me out of the hospital and took me to the convention. And I went because they were going to have a banquet and they were going to have a dance. I didn't think about it helping me. But I'd sit in a meeting like old Red Hen and say, here I am, now y'all help me. and I didn't know what to expect. I kept praying for some kind of miracle, some kind of magic to happen. But I went, and the meeting started. I got Peggy by the hand. I said, let's sit down back here tonight. This man got up and said, my name is Jack Burnham. He said, well, I wasn't supposed to come tonight. He said, God's got one man he wants me to talk to. Please be quiet and let him listen. And cold tears just go all over me every time I think about it, because I know he can't talk to me. He said, my God loved me enough to send a man all the way from Brooklyn to Kansas to talk to me. Now, maybe 1,000 people thought the same thing. I hope to be it. But Jack Brennan came and talked to me that night. He said he was 12 and his little brother was 10. And daddy was drunk and they were hiding from him. And little brother found a jug of wine and he tasted it. And he said, oh, Jack, this stuff is sweet. Oh, it's so sweet and good. You taste it. And Jack tasted it and said it wasn't sweet and it wasn't sour. So it was absolute magic. The most wonderful thing he ever put in his mouth. He woke up in his mother's arms and she was crying and saying, Jack, I can't stand two of you. He said, Mama, Mama, what happened? She said, you drank the whole jug and you passed out this Sunday morning. He said, don't cry, Mama, don't cry. Please don't cry. He said, I won't ever touch another drop long as I live. Planning where he would get his next drink. He was in Brooklyn at the time. He later grew up and was a real man for the mafia. And he lost that job because he kept blacking out. They didn't know whether he'd taken to the jailhouse or to the hideout. So he lost his job. His wife, he'd gotten married in the meantime. She had threatened to burn down every saloon in the neighborhood if they sold him a drink, so he was about to go crazy. She said, Jack, they started something new in AA, something called Alcoholics Anonymous. Said, if you go with me, I'll buy you a drink. I'd have followed him to hell. And he would have too, and he went for the drink. He said, I got over there in all he hurried, but if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. He said, any fool knew that. He came back and things got worse and worse and worse in Brooklyn. And then they threw him out of Brooklyn. Before they threw him out, his wife got court papers that had him thrown out of the house. The two lawmen came to serve him. He whipped them. And they came back with eight and broke both jaws and all his fingers. They woke up in a straitjacket in Bellevue Hospital. When he got out, he's kind of like some of us. He went looking for them and he happened to find all eight of them together. And they broke both jaws and all his fingers and they woke up in a straitjacket in Bellevue Hospital. And as he put it himself, said, would you believe I found him 12 more times? This man had my attention now. I was really listening to him, sure enough. And then they threw him out of Brooklyn. The only man till this day, as I understand it, that would've been thrown out of Brooklyn. But he went on the Bowery on Skid Row. You know what Skid Row is, I'm sure all of you. He's been there nearly 3 years. He was in the back of a filthy restaurant. In a filthy restroom with his chin hung on the commode, trying to get a drink to stay down. His very insides was coming out and he was bleeding practically to death. Don't forget he had never been but to one meeting. In the middle of all of that, a voice said, Jack, you had enough, call away. That was my job, but he's talking to Jack. He crawled out on the sidewalk. It took him a long time to get out there. He was so weak. When he got out there, people were afraid of him. And finally someone said, yes, we'll call. And he said, the little man, the little woman came with all the love in the world and said, come on, go with us and you may never drink again. That was 28 years ago that night. That's not God. Jack was a messenger. Jack died June the 6th of this year. But he wasn't a God. He was a messenger just telling me that he could stay sober and that I could stay sober. And God works through all you wonderful people. And he sent a lot of people from Thompson, which is 22 miles from my home. We don't have AA at home. And they invited me to that group. And I would come, and the doctors wasn't wrong. I had an awful lot of brain damage. I couldn't find a meeting in a little town 2 nights on the road to save my neck. I'd pull off the road and sit and try because I couldn't find where I was going. And I'd get there sometimes halfway and sometimes when it was nearly over. And they would hug me and they would kiss me and say, Jimmy, we love you. The compassion, the love that these people had for me was absolutely unreal. And not just for me, but any alcoholic. But I kept going and kept going to these meetings. This was after I had heard Jack in 75. And that old sponsor I told you about, he finally told me, he said, Jimmy, quit trying to stay sober. And that like scared me to death. I said, Jack, the police don't give up on me. He said, oh no. So I want you to let go and let God, because you can't do it. And think of this, that if you're sober, they're not going to lock you up anywhere. They're not going to put you in a jail or a hospital. If you're sober, you're going to stay free. And I hung on to it, and I hung on to it, and God started this miracle for you people. And I owe you so much, you can never imagine how much I owe all of you. But the miracle started working in June 1st, 1980. I had a birthday. I don't know who was most shocked, me or them. They didn't think I'd live long enough to have a birthday. But things began to get better. The next year, I got where I could find the meetings and get there on time most of the time. After about 2 years of sobriety, and then people began to ask me to speak here and there and yonder. Meetings, you know, distances apart. And you know, when a cop's got you and you're drunk, he's going to kick you and cuss you and call you an SO and throw you in the back of the car. But you pull up to a cop like I'm dressed now and say, "Officer, can you tell me where the Lower Tabernacle Baptist Church is?" He says, "Why, yes, sir, I sure can, sir." And that just tickles the hell out of me. Just tickles me to death. And I didn't know where anything was. My mind worked real slow, and if I was speaking 40 miles away, I'd leave 4 hours ahead of time. Because I had to find the place, and I couldn't drive fast enough to, you know, I drove 35 and 40. My whole family kidded me about it. But I kept doing that. And even though when my wife would be with me and I'd learn where to go to these meetings, I love to stop a cop and ask him directions. She'd be with me and say, "Oh, don't bother a cop." And I said, "Yeah, I want to hear him. I want to hear him. I want to listen to him, Lord." And keep going, and things continue to get better. And I've been sober 3 or 4 years, and I told my wife, I said, "It can't get any better than this." But it did. 5th and 6th year was better. The 8th and 9th year was better. The 11th year now is better. And I've learned, and I know. But if I do what I'm supposed to do, if I don't drink today, and I go to meetings today, and I try to live these 12 steps today, my life's going to get better. It's up to me. Nobody else. It's up to me. If I do what I'm supposed to do, it's going to get better. And I've been telling my sponsors and my sponsorees and all this for years, you do what you're supposed to do and it'll work. My 2 sons, 130 and 125, they went through hell with me. We lived across the street from the school. They see me and the cops fighting all up in the yard, and all the classmates would see such, and they see me crawling from the car to the house and all those kind of things. It was pure hell for them. We had an awful wall between us. Especially my oldest. I kept telling these people, you do what you're supposed to do, and it'll happen. About 8 weeks ago, my son had to go in the hospital. And 3 days later, he called me and wanted me to come see him. You can't imagine how unreal that is, the way our situation was. And I called 3 or 4 of my old sponsors, and I said, "Y'all pray for me. He wants to see me." And I stopped and got a copy of ACO, say, you know what I'm saying? We got a copy of that to take with me. And we got the wall broken down, and he hugged me, and he told me that he loved me. And I can hug him and tell him that I love him, and that's one of the greatest miracles I know of. Because for years and years, I hadn't touched him, I don't think, since he was 3 or 4 years old. He didn't want me to get near him. He didn't want me to touch him. He didn't want me to tell him anything. But you people kept telling me if I do what I'm supposed to do, everything else will take care of itself, and that's a good example. It sure is. And it's such a joy now to see him and be able to hug him and just tell him I love him. I hope you understand how important that is to me. All of you people gave me that. The program gave me that. So I go back a week and do what I couldn't do. And I do a lot of things different now. Brain damage is the greatest advantage I have on lots of things. I thoroughly enjoy my brain damage. You know, I really do. I live 2 blocks from Mangan, and I can ride up and come home in a minute and a half. It don't take long. And used to do it more years ago than I do now, but I still do it a lot. I'd ride up there and circle and come home. Just ride up and ride back. A young man out in his yard one day, and I rode up by him, came right back mine, and rode up and came right back mine many times that day. And he saw me that night, and he said, "Coach," I'm back to coach again, thank goodness, said, "You passed me at least 30 times today and came right back by me." He said, "Where was you going?" I said, "Nowhere." He said, "Well, what were you doing?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, why were you doing it?" And I grinned at him and said, "Cause I can." I do a lot of things because I can. Nothing else. I was locked up so much. And I told him, I said, "Matt, do you remember me telling you about the jails and hospitals I was locked up in, watching cars go up and down the road and say, 'I'm going to do that. I'm going to ride.'" I said, "I'll do it now." And I enjoy doing it. Brain damage, I can come in a meeting like this size, any size, hug and kiss all the ladies, go out the door and wait 3 or 4 minutes, come back in, pretend that it's got there, and hug and kiss them all again. I did it 4 times one night. Young lady said to the older lady that said, he's been here and here doing that 4 times. She said, shh, leave him alone. He's got brain damage. So, by the way, if I missed any of you ladies tonight, please see me before you leave. Please do. That's a big part of AA to me. AA to me is the most wonderful thing that ever was on the face of the earth. My whole day when I wake up in my own bed sober and I start thinking about this trip up here and the other places I get to go and the people I get to see, I get so excited I can't hardly stand it. And I don't like to ride interstates unless I have to. I like to ride country roads through Georgia and Carolina. I know somebody in AA not near the town. And when I ride through that town, I get that warm glow. I get that good feeling. And I see one of our bumper stickers. Easy does it one day at a time. I say, man, that's one of us. I get that feeling all over. That just warm, glowing feeling on me. Knowing that I'm going to see you people. Knowing that you're available to me. 86,000 groups. And I'm welcome. Can you imagine that? That I am welcome in all these places? You're welcome in all these places? Is this the greatest thing that ever was? Again, if you don't have a whole lot or good measure of peace and joy and happiness and serenity, you're cheating yourself because it's out there. Newcomers, I almost envy you because you can't imagine what a journey you've gone. You just can't imagine what a trip you're on because it gets the good and good and good to this can't hardly stand it. This can't. Appreciate it again, all of you, so much for letting me come. This beautiful, lovely hotel, a lovely city. I've enjoyed it also very much. I appreciate all of you's hospitality. I would try to quote something, but I don't think I'll make it now. Thank you so much.